SIS 301, Spring 2009. This is the second supplemental lecturelet. These are not planned things, but like the first one, this is something that came up in class and I don't think was really fleshed out adequately in class, and had a couple of people who had some questions for me afterwards about it, so I thought I would just very quickly throw something up that allowed me to talk a little bit more slowly through the specifics of what it is that I meant. And what I meant was this distinction between motive and intent, which is something that we touched on a little bit in class, which is not completely surprising when one is talking about constructivism, that a distinction between motive and intent tends to manifest. Not necessarily in those terms, but at least the concept seems to come about quite often for reasons that I think should be pretty clear after I explain what the heck I was actually talking about. Because as I said, we went through this a little quickly in class, and so I want to slow down a little bit. So, motive and intent, the way that I am talking about them here, are forms of explanation. These are ways of explaining particular kinds of observed social outcomes. So, an explanation based on motivation would say that anything that we see, any kind of social activity, social action that we see, has to be explained in terms of some kind of internal subjective decision-making process. So, some actor does something because of some kind of decision-making, because of some kind of weighing of alternatives, because of something that goes on inside of them somehow. Think about this in terms of individuals. The idea would be that you do certain things because you have thought them through in some way, and that the central causal process takes place inside, internally to the actor in some way. Similar kinds of things are the case when we talk about collective actors, state action. State action being driven by a motivation. What would be a motivation at the level of the state would be, again, an internal process of decision. So that would be to say a state acts in a particular way because of some kind of internal deliberation process that propels it to do something from the inside out. That's a motivational explanation. Lots of our everyday, average, ordinary explanations that we used when we're not doing IR theory or social theory speak tend to be motivational explanations. There are concrete historical reasons for this that I'll mention in a minute. But for now, what I want to do is I want to establish that there's another kind of explanation as well, which doesn't actually talk about internal subjective processes, things going on inside of actors that force or compel or push them to do particular things. And that would be a kind of explanation based on intention. And an intentional explanation, would focus not on internal decision-making processes, but on intersubjective, so not inside, but between actors, an intersubjective process, a public process, and in particular a process of meaning-making, a process through which things are made meaningful. And when we talk about an intentional explanation, then what we are saying is the things that the actors think inside of their heads are irrelevant to the outcome. What actually matters is not what actors think inside their heads. What matters is what goes on publicly between them as there's a discussion or a negotiation or some other way in which social meaning is hammered out interactively in that intersubjective space that exists between two actors. So that's the rough cut of what an intentional explanation looks like. I'll talk a little bit more about these on the next slide, but I do want to point out that this distinction between motivational explanation and intentional explanation, this distinction should not be too unfamiliar if you've been listening through this whole series, because this is actually very similar, kind of maps onto the distinction I talked about a couple weeks ago between the economists and the sociologists as ideal typical forms of explaining social action and social outcomes. Economists want to explain things in a way that is reductionist to the level of the individual. So it is individuals that do things, and those individual things that are done have to be explained in some sense by talking about characteristics of individuals and by talking about decisions that individuals make. And the sociological approach, ideal typically, is about the public intersubjective realm of meaning and norms and so on and so forth, and doesn't actually go down and get inside of the heads of individual actors. So this is very similar. This motivation versus intention distinction is very, very similar to this economist sociology distinction that I was introducing a little bit earlier. And if you remember the context in which I introduced that, this was at the beginning when we were talking about constructivism, because a lot of the initial and subsequent constructivist incursions into IR have been about trying to produce something other than a motivational form of explanation, saying we can't just reduce everything to individuals and what they think, or to individual state actors and what goes on in their domestic life. So, elaborating on this just a little bit, motives and motivational explanation. What are some examples of a motivational explanation, or the kind of motives that are cited in a motivational explanation? Well, one of the more common is beliefs. If I believe something, then that belief, that thing that I hold, that assent that I hold subjectively in my consciousness, in a motivational explanation, then propels me to do something. So, I show up for class because I believe that class starts at 2:10. In that statement, the causal location is inside of my consciousness someplace. It is my belief that pushes me to do something. Or I believe that it's going to rain and therefore I take my umbrella. Or I believe that doing a supplemental lecture led on motives and intent is going to be useful for some people. Therefore I do it. Right? Again, not saying whether any of those statements that I just made are true or false, particularly not the one about class starting at 2:10 and everybody showing up at 2:10, including me. That aside, what's important here is not the truth or falsity of the particular claims. What's important here is that in all of those sentences, in all of those characterizations, what is producing the action is a subjective state of mind, a belief. Similarly, we could talk about expectations being a form of motive in a motivational explanation. You know, I look ahead to a particular kind of future. So I expect that I'm going to be graduating at a certain point in time, so I start making preparations to get a job. I expect that eventually my kids are going to go to college, and therefore I start putting money away in a college fund. Right? I expect that the car is going to run out of gas soon, so I go gas it up. Again, in all of those claims and all of those explanations, the outcome, the action, is explained with reference to a subjective state of mind and the way in which it is structured. Doing this on a state level would be something like France expected Germany to invade, and therefore they built the Maginot Line, which is a line of fortifications that was built after the First World War. Was spectacularly unsuccessful because the Germans, as anyone who knows early World War II military history knows, Germans put a bunch of tanks, went through the Ardennes Forest, came around, and actually pinned large portions of the French troops to the Maginot Line on the other side. So, didn't work quite the way they had planned. That aside, the explanation of the Maginot Line in terms of the expectations of the French would be a motivational explanation. Calculations of interest would be a motivational explanation. You know, these sorts of investment decisions were made because somebody thought that they would be able to make a great deal of money by doing it. If I'm trying to figure out whether or not it makes sense for me to run the light at this particular point in time, well, I need to calculate whether it is better for me to gain a few seconds by running this particular traffic light versus the chances of either running into somebody or if there's a cop there, right? So I calculate what my interest is in this particular situation, and that calculation, the subjective calculation of interest, that's a motivational explanation too. And this, in fact, is why an account based on incentives is ultimately a motivational account, because incentives by themselves don't do anything. Incentives provide a menu of options from which an actor chooses. Incentives. Incentives, then, are, in fact, the input to a decision-making process. And because of the fact that they are an input to a decision-making process, there needs to be something to link the input to an output, and that is a motivation. That is, again, a subjective internal process of deliberation. So once again, internalization. Internalization is key, absolutely key to a motivational explanation. There's an external environment. Individuals are seated in or living within that external environment. They perceive it. They look at it. Information is taken in, but it is the internalization of the external environment. That internalization is the key thing. And the work, the movement, the causal energy is internal to the actors in some way. So that is important for a motivational explanation, this internalization of what is outside. Now, on the other hand, let's talk about an intentional explanation. What kinds of things would be intentions if those things we were just talking about are all motivations and motives? What's an intention? Well, the performance of identity is an intention. Socially meaningful behavior. Behavior that looks like it has a certain kind of meaning, or behavior that has a certain kind of meaning that is publicly negotiated. So, not, you know, if we say something like, my being a professor causes me to do something, that's not quite the performance of identity. But instead, if we say something like, by occupying this particular role, and by performing professorness, you know, by performing professorness, certain things arise. So by my doing, by enacting what it means to be a professor, so by my wearing a suit, by my interrupting people to call on other people and trying to sort of steer the discussion and so on and so forth, the social actions then arise from performance, right? They arise from the ways in which I take the individual pieces of the role or the socially meaningful activity of teaching as a professor and then combine them in a particular way, right? That yields actions, that yields outcomes. That's an intentional explanation, because it really doesn't matter what's inside of my head. It doesn't matter whether I think I'm playing a game. It doesn't matter whether I really mean everything that I say. What matters is that I say certain things in certain contexts and do certain things in certain contexts. And that is enough for this kind of intentional explanation. Similarly, the legitimation of conduct. So if a state does something and gives a set of reasons why it has done something, the intentional explanation bet would be that it is, in some way, the existence of those reasons, the existence of the ability to give reasons that are publicly acceptable to a certain group that is relevant to this particular thing. Could be the domestic public, could be the international audience, could be some combination of both, that it is the existence of those reasons which is what makes possible the outcome. So we can explain what the state did when it, quote-unquote, declared war, right? We can understand that in terms of the distribution of cultural resources that make going to war into a meaningful action. And again, it doesn't matter for an intentional explanation exactly what's going on inside of the heads of the individuals who did this, or what's going on inside of the bureaucracy that actually issued this particular declaration. This is not about the motivation. This is about the social meaningfulness. No, that's not the right word. This is about the comprehensibility of the action. Right? And the bet here with any intentional explanation is that incomprehensible action is problematic. Action is socially meaningful. And it is the process of making it socially meaningful which produces it in some way. That's what an intentional explanation is all about. Similarly, if you have actors, states, individuals, whatever, constructing interests by talking about different kinds of norms and rules and various things going on and arranging them to make a more or less compelling argument, then what's actually doing the work there is not what goes on inside of heads, but the arrangement, the public arrangement of resources, right? The justification of action, the saying things like, we, the United States, have an interest, have a moral obligation to stop genocide in this particular situation. An intentional explanation would say it doesn't matter whether anybody actually believes that if they say it. What matters is they say it. And by saying it, they perform a certain kind of United States-ness. They enact a certain kind of meaning of what it is to be the United States. And certain implications flow from that performance. Certain implications flow from and out of that construction. that construction of what it means to have something be in our interest. Now, where this gets confusing is that often people will use this very materialist, economistic language when they're constructing interests in certain sorts of contexts. But it matters an awful lot whether you think that A, the reason that actors do things is because of their material interests, or B, the reason that actors do things is because of the availability of a language that allows them to construct their interests in materialist terms. Right, that's a very fine line, but a very, very important one from an analytical point of view. Because with an intentional explanation, the thing that you are primarily looking at, the thing you're primarily seizing on as the explanatory core, is the stabilization of various kinds of contingent borders and ambiguous meanings and ambiguous identities or unclear identities. The idea is stabilization is what produces action. So it's not something as simple as I like playing the guitar and therefore I play the guitar. That would be a motivational explanation. Right, there's some kind of internal process whereby I figure out that, you know, playing the guitar brings me a certain amount of utility, or I like, I get some sort of benefit from doing so, and therefore I do it. Right, then it's the benefit in my getting of it and my recognition of getting it that explains why I continue to do these things. With an intentional explanation, you don't do that. With an intentional explanation, you say, it is perhaps my performance of being a guitar player, the fact that I say it in certain kinds of contexts, the fact that it comes up at various times when I'm trying to assert things about who I am, it is that that then stabilizes what the different kinds of boundaries of action might be and says this is an acceptable thing for me to do. Why is it an acceptable thing for me to do? It's an acceptable thing for me to do because it's an acceptable thing for me to go and spend time practicing my guitar right now because I'm a guitarist and I need to go and actually play my guitar. It's not about whether or not I actually am a guitarist. The action can be explained simply by looking at the phrase, looking at the way in which the claim legitimates the activity of me practicing the guitar. And this actually turns out to be a good thing from an analytical standpoint, because if my playing the guitar was as a result of my being a guitarist, then you have a tautology, because then my guitar playing, which is the thing that marks me as a guitarist, is then what explains my playing the guitar, which is very circular, and that's a problem. So to avoid that circularity, an intentional explanation would say it's not the some sort of dispositional condition of the person or the actor. You know, the U.S. doesn't do things because it actually is the city on the hill. Or the U.S. doesn't do things because it is the shining beacon of light and justice. It is, however, the case that the U.S. might do things because of the publicly acceptable claim that it is the shining city on the hill and the beacon of life and justice. The causal energy moves from the inside of the actor to the way in which that actor's boundaries are stabilized. That's what an intentional explanation is all about, sort of living on that particular boundary line, that particular middle space which is ambiguous, and it is through interventions in that which lock it down temporarily that outcomes are produced. So if we were thinking here in slightly more concrete terms, if we're thinking about certain kinds of public policies, right? If we're thinking about, I'll just pick a random example here, the Marshall Plan. Again, let me take something I actually have written about. So let's talk about the Marshall Plan. A motivational explanation for the Marshall Plan would be to say, okay, what were people thinking? What did people believe? What were their expectations? How did they calculate their interests? What were their actual objective material positions, and how did that relate to what the outcome was? So you would explain the outcome, the Marshall Plan, the action that was undertaken. You would explain this reductively in terms of figuring out what's going on inside people's heads. Instead, if we wanted to explain this with intention, then we would not go inside people's heads. We would instead look to see how people negotiated ambiguous social meaning. So what were the ways in which people tried to justify and to legitimate and also to delegitimate and attack the idea of the Marshall Plan? How did those things play out? How did these different kinds of claims interact in particular kinds of social settings? We could fast forward a little bit and think more about something like the Iraq War. So the motive would be, what exactly was Colin Powell thinking when he went to the UN? What exactly was George W. Bush thinking when he kept talking about Iraq as being a place that was somehow linked to Al-Qaeda and 9/11? And then you would have all these tracings about who had what information when and so on and so forth. And it's all about this internal process, as opposed to the intent version, which is to say it actually doesn't matter what was going on inside Bush's head. It doesn't matter what was going on inside Colin Powell's head. What matters is how they and others sought to stabilize American identity in the post 9/11 period, and certain consequences and implications flowed from that stabilization. If the United States was going to be articulated as a certain kind of country, then it had to do certain things, and some of the certain things that it had to do involved going in and trying to eliminate those that had been branded as part of the axis of evil, those that were supposedly dictators funding terrorism, and so on and so forth. This is also why, incidentally, North Korea starts to look like a huge anomaly, because then if the U.S. is going to start putting pressure on Iran and if it's going to invade Iraq, why is the U.S. not really going to do much about North Korea except call for multilateral, multi-party talks? That starts to look weird. But it only starts to look weird because of a particular performance of the United States, but just a particular way of articulating U.S. identity and the conceptual borders of the United States or the conceptual borders of America in such a way that America was an anti-terrorist crusader and arrayed against these rogue states. So that would be a kind of intentional explanation, not inside of heads, not inside of bureaucracies, but public performances and negotiations and attempts to lock down ambiguity. You'll notice the data can often be very much the same in these two cases. It's just what people do with it that differs. Because a motivational explanation takes a public performance and says, this is either a reliable guide to what people were thinking or it's an unreliable guide to what people were thinking. And an intentional explanation would look at that very same public performance and say, this is an intervention into an ongoing stream of negotiation about the social meaning of various things and about the acceptability of various things. And what we have to do then is trace what the effects of that are. Who picks it up? How does it get picked up? Does it get reincorporated into things? What happens after this speech is made? Do people grab pieces of this speech and start reproducing it? Did the language show up elsewhere? Does it just fall completely flat? Is there a rebuttal? Does it get retracted? So on and so forth. So it's all about that intersubjective space and watching how that space plays out and how the shape of that space is negotiated and renegotiated. And I stress again, this claim about motivations and intentions, not a fundamental ontological claim. This is an analytical claim. This is about explanations. There is nothing in a motivational explanation which says that there is no such thing as public meaning. It just says that public meaning is not causally relevant for explaining action. Similarly, there's nothing in an intentional explanation which says that people don't have or actors don't have motives. It just says that motives are, strictly speaking, irrelevant to the explanation of action. So these are analytical claims. This is about how one produces certain kinds of explanations. That's what this is about. Now, if we refract this back into IR theory and into the IR theoretical discussions we've been having over the last few weeks, a few interesting things shake out. For instance, if we start trying to look at motivational explanations and ask ourselves who has motivational explanations, well, it's very clear that liberals and liberal constructivists in IR theory all have motivational explanations. For liberals, it's all about individual material rational interests, for the most part. For liberal constructivists, it's more what Max Weber would have called ideal interests. So individuals can be motivated by concern for general welfare. They can be motivated by various sorts of notions of community, and they can be motivated by the desire to eliminate war and things like this. So liberals and liberal constructivists still lodge causal power within actors, within people, within states, within consciousnesses. That's where the causal power happens. There are even some realists, actually, that locate things in here, particularly those realists that are very interested in trying to talk about not balances of capabilities as much as balance of threats, which involves assessing what other states are likely to do. And there's a whole question within realist thought about how you assess what other countries are likely to do. The position that says that we should use people's material balance of forces indicators, and those can be ways of figuring out what they're likely to do. Others say, no, you've got to really watch their public speeches, and you've got to watch their domestic politics, and then you could figure out what they're likely to do. Again, the whole idea there is that that relies on a certain kind of motivation in order to explain things, that different states would do different things because of these motivational factors. So there's a whole branch of realists that are very interested in trying to figure out and assess the motivations of actors as a way of explaining stuff. And if you think about it in terms of the classical political theorists we were reading, all the state of nature theorists are all interested in motive. Right? Hobbes, the whole thing is people are motivated rationally to get out of the state of nature because they look around and realize that it's really bad, and so they want to get out of it. Similarly for people like Locke, and look around and see the state of nature is rather inconvenient, and so they're motivated to get out of it. And that's a lot of the causal work for those kinds of theories involves individuals realizing things and then doing things based on their realizations. And in particular, also Hobbes and Locke realizing things and then trying to give everybody else these explanations so they also will realize these things. So that kind of Enlightenment liberalism, that kind of state of nature theory, very much motivational explanation. Who would an intentional explanation be? Well, realist constructivists, I think. You probably guessed that. But in addition to realist constructivists, there are some realists who would say that motivation is completely irrelevant. A lot of the classical realists were very skeptical of the idea that you could figure out what state leaders were thinking or what states as a whole were thinking, what their motivation was. So that instead you had to conduct policy based not on their motivation, but you had to conduct policy based simply on the possibility that they might threaten you at some point. Right, so there's a whole way in which classical realism especially, is a kind of pessimistic reading of this situation where you can't figure out the motivation of particular actors. And in that sense, the only way you can explain things is in terms of public interaction, public intersubjective negotiation of stuff, so diplomacy. Right? So that becomes then where a lot of the classical realists will end up looking, not inside, because you can't look inside to find out what the decision-making processes are like. So those would be much more intentional explanations. And again, that's only some realists. Particularly the more contemporary realists are usually more interested in motives and interested in trying to figure out ways of ascertaining the motives of other states. Again, the classical realists are generally less concerned about this and say, it doesn't really matter. Besides, even if you thought a state was motivated by something or state leaders were motivated by something, they might change their mind. Because if the real causal power is what goes on inside their heads, maybe that will shift. And if that shifts, maybe the different things will be going on inside their head. And all of a sudden, they used to be your friends, but maybe they're not anymore. That's a really inconstant basis on which to place things. So we should instead look to other things and look to public intersubjective negotiations. We should look to behavior, and we should look to diplomacy, and we should look to those kinds of things. And that might give us a better sense of how to make policy. And of course, Rousseau, Kant, Hegel, etc. are all very interested in intentional explanations. I mean, Rousseau even sidesteps the question of why people might have been motivated to leave the state of nature, replacing it with the, for him, much more interesting question of why, or not even why, but how do we make the current arrangement that is not the state of nature legitimate? Right? That becomes his operating question. And Kant and Hegel's whole thing about actions being guided by something that the individuals involved are not even aware of, that's a big part of their particular kind of historical and philosophical account. But even Machiavelli is somewhat involved in this kind of intentional explanation. Think about the appearances that the prince maintains. And that appearance and the maintenance of that appearance is a sufficient explanation for certain kinds of things that the prince does. Regardless, and in Machiavelli's case, it's not even regardless of what the prince's motives are. In Machiavelli's case, it's the prince's motives are diametrically opposed to, like, being benevolent to the population. But being benevolent to the population turns out to be a useful way to get the population on your side. So there are aspects of Machiavelli that are very much wrapped up with this more intentional explanation, where what matters is public image and public meaning and intersubjective negotiation of action, rather than some internal subjective motor that propels action in a particular way. And that fundamentally is the difference between a motivational explanation and an intentional explanation, or between motives and intents when it comes to thinking about social explanation in general, and for our case, for IR in particular. And that's basically the point that I was trying to make all together too quickly in class last time, and I hope by elaborating it, I've made it a little bit more comprehensible. At least that has been my, well, I could say motive, I could say intent, or I could just say both and stop. So I'm just going to say both and stop.